Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Today we're joined by Sam Curtis. Sam Curtis is CEO of Big Sofa Technologies. Welcome to the show, Sam. It's really good to have you join us today.
Great. No, it's brilliant. Thanks a lot, Ben. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure. This is going to be really interesting. So before we get into the main bulk of the conversation, if you could just give us like a bit of background on yourself and your career history to get to CEO of this Big Sofa Technologies, that'd be great.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks. So the quick part of history is sort of left uni and first job was a recruitment consultant for about 3 years, essentially recruiting accountants, which I wasn't particularly good at. And so after doing that for 2 or 3 years, I sort of switched careers and joined a company that was part of a big market research company called Kantar. So I sort of joined their grad scheme in 2006 and ended up working at Kantar for about 11 years and did a mixture of sort of sales and account type of roles, as well as a sort of innovation roles. So developing new approaches to research and working with different data sources and things like that. So I did that for sort of 11 years. And one of the things I was conscious of is there were, I think from a data perspective, a lot of really interesting new sources of data, a lot of interesting startups that were working with sort of quite disruptive technologies. And so I sort of thought after sort of doing the corporate thing for 11 years, I would try something different. So I started off sort of consulting, and then I've worked in a couple of different startups, mainly I'd sort of say in sort of sales and client roles, but also at the same time sort of helping those businesses to develop propositions as well. So yeah, joined Big Sofa a couple of years ago and initially running the UK sort of client services team, and then our CEO decided after 3 years to step down a couple of months ago, and so I've officially been in this role for about a month. And yeah, so all sort of very new, but that's a sort of quick potted history.
Cool. I just really want to find out. In fact, you know what? This is quite a big question, so we'll come to this in a little bit. Let's get the small ones out of the way first before we delve straight into the big ones. So just before we get into the big conversation here, can you give us a bit of insight into Big Sofa Technologies and what service it is that you provide there?
We are a technology company that works primarily with video content, and the sort of industry we're in is the sort of market research and insight industry. So I think the way to think about what we do is video as a source of insight and data. Video is incredibly rich, whether that's video you're working in terms of what people are saying, or it could be video that is what we call sort of passive. So we might put cameras into people's homes, into cars, into restaurants, obviously with their consent, and look at how they're behaving within those spaces. But a lot of that content is essentially video as a form is unstructured. Mm-hmm. So we've developed technology that helps us to essentially ingest, structure, and codify that video, whether it's language or behavior, turn that into a source of data. And then we work in a couple of different ways. So we either work directly with large clients, I guess, so we work with people like sort of Pepsi and P&G and Spotify and Unilever and these types of businesses where we work with directly. And then we also partner with other agencies as well who may use our technology and data and will consult off the back of it. So yeah, so we're sort of, I guess, in the business of trying to extract data and insight from video at some form of scale.
God, fascinating, really. What amazes me about this is that, you know, when I started doing these podcasts a few years ago, I had absolutely no idea the power of data. Really, I didn't. Yeah. And, you know, it fascinates me, especially speaking to you today, Sam. But it seems like with Big Sofa Technologies, it's kind of quite ahead of the curve with what you're doing, really. And what I want to find out is, how do you stay ahead of the curve? How do you continue to stay ahead of the curve? Because this is quite remarkable what you're doing.
Yeah, and being ahead of the curve is good and bad. So obviously it's good. I think obviously as any business wants, especially smaller ones, you know, you want an element of differentiation. You want the businesses that work with you to be excited to work with you, and actually the people in your business that work with you to also feel like they're at the cutting edge and they're working on something exciting. So there's lots of good things about it. The challenge, as always, in the cutting edge is then how quickly does it take for the sort of the industry and the clients that are buying data to sort of catch on and catch up with some of the stuff that you're doing. Yeah. And it's fair to say at some points we've been slightly further ahead of where some clients and some businesses are. So it can be good and bad. What I would say in terms of how you stay ahead, it's really about focus. Because again, we're a relatively small business. We're not sort of VC funded or, you know, have a huge, you know, financial reserve to sort of draw upon. So we need to be very, very focused in terms of what we do. Mm-hmm. And it's better to do a couple of things incredibly well than try and do lots of things slightly poorly. Mm-hmm. So whether that's focusing on, I think when it comes to obviously developing our technology, it's focusing on things that are not necessarily that easily replicable, is a hard word to say.
Yeah.
And then also in terms of the industries we focus on from a sales perspective, is looking at industries where video is maybe underutilized at present. So it's a little bit about focus and making sure that we're developing things that are unique and valuable, and we're going after areas that are maybe at the moment not saturated with other businesses trying to do that stuff. That brings another set of challenges. Sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. Another set of challenges in terms of, you know, we're quite often, you know, one of the first businesses to be doing some of the things that we do. And so there are not always a lot of learnings to build on. We can't sort of speak to other people that have failed in the past at some of this stuff. So we do fail and we do have things that go wrong. But the main thing is, as long as we have the focus and direction, we'll solve problems as we go and ultimately try and stay ahead.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. And also, I mean, in recent times, people have, like the general public, have been kind of more fearful around what data they share. So, you know, how do you enable that trust in you know, clients and people that are really scared of what data they're sharing, basically?
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting things is I'd probably argue most people are quite ambivalent actually about their data and maybe not particularly knowledgeable actually about what data is being collected and why it's being collected and how it's being used. And I would probably say the majority of people, when the pop-ups come up on your computer on every single website asking you to about the cookies, I can guarantee most people won't read any of it. And sort of things like that. Saying all of that, obviously, you know, when you're working with video, it is one of the, you know, potentially the most intrusive type of data you can imagine. It's very personal data as well. You know, we're dealing with, you know, language and faces and behavior and all of this sort of stuff. So there's a few things that you have to do. One is you need to make sure that you are getting consent of people. And by consent, you're being very, very explicit about what data you're collecting, why you're collecting it, and what you're using it for. And you actually spend a lot of time with people in terms of making sure they understand that, not just sending them a big legal document, but actually speaking to them and helping them to understand it. So that's one part. The other part is from a technology perspective in terms of how you're actually handling that video and making sure that the entire workflow essentially is protected. So we spend a lot of time making sure that we're sort of ISO certified. And that independent people are checking and verifying our processes around how we're handling that information. And then I think to go to a slightly more extreme example, in some of the businesses we're working with who are particularly sensitive about the video and the data we're collecting, we will actually delete the raw video after, you know, once we've extracted the data from that video. It will essentially sort of remove it and delete it. So there's really those three things. It's about consent. It's about having, you know, robust processes and making sure that data is protected. And then it's going to probably a little bit further than what the regulations require you to do with how you handle that information. And again, rather than reacting to changes in privacy laws, trying to get a little bit ahead of them as much as possible. Saying all of that, you can do all of that and there will still be businesses that do feel a little bit nervous about this sort of stuff, which is understandable. But yeah, I think you have to try and go beyond. I think in the business we're in, you have to go a little bit beyond what the law requires you to do, I think, in order to get people's trust.
Yeah, absolutely. So extracting data from video, essentially, and recognizing that human behavior. So
yeah,
this would be AI, essentially. Is that correct?
AI and humans.
Okay.
So yes. So, and I think it's important that we sort of use both. And it comes down to one being that, well, as everyone knows, AI is not perfect and it's really good at some things and it's not others. And humans are particularly good at some things as well. So I think to maybe talk a little bit about how we use both. And one of the things I would sort of say is, because obviously video is incredibly rich. And I think when you rely on AI alone, AI is particularly good at collecting what I would say is relatively superficial data.
Right.
So if you take an example like a video from a retail outlet, if you're in a convenience store and sort of things like that. Mm-hmm. So AI is particularly good at recognizing people and it can track people around the space, but it might not be particularly good at recognizing pain points. So could an AI tell you that somebody's got confused by a shelf layout? Could AI tell you, for example, how good is it at distinguishing one bottle of washing up liquid from another bottle of washing up liquid? Mm. So I think there's a limit to what AI can do at the moment. The way in which we're using AI is, if you imagine from video, you just get huge quantities of stuff. Because I think, for example, if we're in people's homes, we, you know, in some cases, we're in homes for an entire year.
Wow.
And so collecting thousands of hours of content. And let's say if we're interested in how people are using the washing machine as an example, we might collect, just say, 20,000 hours of video, but actually only 1,000 hours of that video, say, is relevant behavior. Mm-hmm. And so what we're using machines to do is actually zero in on what the relevant behavior is. So we could train a machine to recognize when somebody uses a washing machine. But then actually we'd probably use humans to go tell us whether this is, are they using colors or whites? Are they using pods or powder? Again, are there any pain points? Do we see any risks around kids, for example, in the laundry room? You know, there were some cases in the US recently where kids have been eating the pods, for example, and sort of stuff like that. But yeah, so again, it's the sort of, to get real value from video and to extract data that is really valuable and data that businesses can make meaningful decisions off, you have to have that combination of AI and human, we believe. Now, obviously, over time, you want the AI to do more, but there is a point at which if the quality of the data you're getting back from the AI is not good enough, then ultimately the humans are sort of stepping in to sort of manage that. But yeah, so I think our focus is really making sure that we extract valuable data from video. And we believe at the moment you can get valuable data by using the sort of AI human hybrid. But obviously the mission in the longer term is for the AI to do more.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so kind of the end goal of all of this is to make humans' lives easier and kind of enable businesses to make better decisions. So yes. I'd just like to dig a little bit deeper into this.
So let's sort of give a tangible example, as they say. So I think if you think about sort of behavior in people's homes, now we obviously spend an enormous amount of time in our homes. And the interesting thing though is businesses know actually very little about the time we're spending in their homes. They might have bit of information on what we're doing digitally, but actually the home is essentially a blind spot for most businesses. Yeah. So the way that they traditionally cover that blind spot is to send surveys out and to ask people, what are you doing and why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. And actually people are hilariously bad at remembering what they do.
Yeah.
So a good example of this is if you look at things like snacking behavior. So people massively underreport how many snacks they would have in a given day. And this particularly came into focus when obviously the pandemic hit and people were at home surrounded by snacks. And everyone sort of went into a bit of a snack frenzy for about a month and then realized they needed to do some exercise. But one of the things actually, one of the behaviors that is largely unseen is a behavior called grazing, which is essentially whilst you might be cooking or cleaning or doing other stuff, grabbing quick handfuls of snacks as you go. And actually, a lot of that behavior is entirely subconscious. So when you ask people to report in a survey what types of snacking are you doing, they don't tell you that they're grazing because they don't remember it. And so essentially grazing has been a massive blind spot for businesses. And actually when we've quantified it in homes, it's anywhere from, I think in the UK, about 35% of all occasions are grazing. In places like India and Mexico, it's about 50%. So wow, huge proportion of grazing. But when you look at the self-reported data, it's that people are reporting this to be about 5% of their behavior. Wow. So most businesses would ignore that behavior entirely, and they would be designing products and designing communications that don't tap into that opportunity. Whereas you look at a brand like Pringles as an example, it's like the ultimate grazing product. You know, you can sort of dip in, you can grab one crisp, or you can grab 10. It's resealable. It doesn't make a big mess on your hands. It's the perfect product for grazing. And actually, It's been one of the fastest growing snacking brands in the last 10 years. I think partly because, well, whether they had behavioral data or not, they realized this was a significant opportunity and they've been able to capitalize it. So it's sort of a slightly long-winded way of sort of saying, actually, when businesses that have this sort of data will end up making different decisions, whether it's in the products they develop, the communications that they put together, they will fundamentally make different decisions than the businesses that don't have that data. Right. So I guess what we're saying is what we're trying to give businesses is an element of competitive advantage as a result of being able to actually see these types of behaviors. And if you don't mind, I've got one other example.
Sure.
Which is, I think if you look at, say, quick service restaurants, and these are sometimes referred to as sort of escape rooms, which is once you walk into a quick service restaurant, like a Burger King or a KFC or something, you don't walk out without food.
Yeah,
now,
yeah,
what we tended to find is actually about 15% of people walk into these places and walk out buying absolutely nothing.
Really? Wow.
And again, which is amazing, usually because they walk in and they see it's crowded and it's messy and it's carnage, and then they go, I don't want to buy anything in there. I'm going to go somewhere else. But again, that's a massive blind spot. And again, most businesses don't know that. And I think if they knew that, they might, again, think a little bit about how they're designing their store, how they're, you know, the entrance of the store, how they're setting up the queuing system to make sure that initial impression as people walk into those environments is more positive. Because again, if they could turn that 15% down to 10 or 5%, it would have a massive impact on their sales. So again, the general, I guess, pitch, if you like, when we're trying to sell to clients is that businesses with this data will end up making different and better decisions as a result.
Yeah, it's amazing, because if you think 15% of people in like a global leading, you know, fast food chain, that's millions, if not billions of pounds worth of...
100%. Know. Yeah.
So, you know, to say how valuable this data is an understatement, because it's incredibly valuable. And also, there's another thing that I'd like to mention, which was, you know, if you talk about data, I thought I was totally unique, and I thought everybody else was totally unique. I thought everybody was an individual. I thought everybody lived their lives in a different way. But I bet now, you know, I'm kind of guessing what your opinions are here. But having been involved with data for so long, I bet you see so many common trends that link people together. I mean,
yeah.
Is there even a unique person in the world, essentially, or do we all have some kind of common?
Well, I think a bit of both. I think it's fair to say that we do believe that everyone is unique. But one of the things that is absolutely true is that everyone is incredibly habitual.
Right.
So if you sort of think, for example, the way that you shop within you know, when you do a weekly shop in, I don't know, Tesco or Sainsbury's or whatever, a lot of that shopping experience is very habitual and very subconscious. You don't spend ages agonizing over what type of milk to buy or what type of snacks to get, you know. And actually, you know, if you visit a store regularly, you've actually mentally worked out where all the different product categories are within that store, and you just go and buy exactly where you buy stuff, which is why whenever they change the store layout, you get unbelievably frustrated because... You've lost track of where. Essentially, the store has made you have to think, which is something humans really, really don't like doing. And the same is true within our home lives. So, for example, like on average, the average family have about 8 meals that they cook regularly a year, which is bonkers when you think about it. Our repertoire of whether it's meals or snacks or is actually very, very limited because we like very habitualized behaviors. We like to do things, our brains like to do things without having to think about it, which is again, when if you walk into somebody's kitchen and you don't know where the tea or coffee is, it's a real stress trying to work out the system. Whereas actually in your own kitchen, you've made a mental map of all of that space and everything like that. So the one thing that everybody has in common is we've created systems, whether it's in the store, whether it's in our home, whether it's in the car, that essentially make our lives easier so we don't have to think. Mm-hmm. And businesses spend a lot of time essentially trying to disrupt these habits, trying to make you do things differently, learn a new recipe, you know, create a new exercise regime, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And actually that's something that most people don't want to do.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we spend a lot of time doing is trying to tell businesses, actually, if you want to change behavior, or if you want to ingrain a new behavior, try and fit into the routines and the habits that people have rather than trying to change and disrupt them. Because I think when you try and change and disrupt, it's actually something that's sort of very hard to do. Mm. So that's the thing that is very, very common. Like even when takeaways, right? We like having variety within our diets and everything like that, but I can guarantee you probably have about 2 to 3 takeaways that you order from all the time.
Yeah.
And actually very rarely you'll actually go and do something that's completely new. So people are incredibly habitual, but saying all of that, the habits that people create are actually quite individual. So there is genuine value in understanding how the individual behaves. And you will obviously find patterns, like certain groups of people will behave in sort of very similar ways. But, you know, being able to actually analyze the individual has quite a bit of value as well, because I think individual people will still surprise you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. And what I really want to find out is, like, how does this differ across different cultures, you know, different countries? And, you know, is it completely different? Are people's data completely different and people's habits completely unique to their culture?
Well, the interesting thing about COVID is COVID actually brought a lot of alignment to people's habits. We were all stuck in our home, around the world. So there was actually quite a bit of alignment. There are some very big differences. So again, if you were to compare like the UK to somewhere like India in terms of the in-home dynamic, and, you know, we put cameras into homes. So on average, we'll probably have about 1 to 2 hours of behavior in a kitchen for a UK home. Mm-hmm. Would have 6 to 7 hours of behavior in an Indian home.
Wow.
Because you'll often have, in most households, there'll be a matriarch who will essentially, you know, and the households tend to be much larger as well, and they will be in there essentially in the kitchen most of the day, sort of cooking, preparing food. Obviously the kids will be running in and out of the kitchen and all sort of that. So, you know, and that leads to at least very sort of different behaviors as well. I think big differences by culture, and a lot of it has to do around the household, you know, the household composition, you know, the role of different people within the family structure as well. Again, what you tend to find is there are some things that some aspects of behavior that are incredibly robust to change.
Right.
So again, one of the things that's very, very common, well, rather sadly actually, is gender roles within the home. So regardless of whether you look at India, whether you look at UK, women are still doing probably about 70% of the cooking, about 60% of the cleaning. They're doing about 80% of the childcare. Mm. And despite COVID happening and men being in the home more, that didn't change at all.
Wow.
So yeah, there are certain things actually that are incredibly hardwired into sort of, I guess, people's psyche and are learned habits and behaviors from a very young age. So when we've analyzed data from children, for example, in homes, we tend to find female children do about 90% more housework than male children. So even sort of today, because they end up mirroring the behavior that they see in their parents. Yeah. So you see differences by culture, but you also see certain things that are incredibly hardwired into humans, and it holds vaguely true sort of across cultures and across continents as well.
Well, it's amazing. It's so eye-opening to hear this. It really is. But I'd really like to find out, you know, if we could wrap up with just one final question, just about the future of Big Sofa Technologies and where you can see yourself in, you know, 6 months' time, a year's time, five years' time, without this sounding like a job interview, but you know what I'm trying to get at.
No, there's a few things that we're working on specifically. So we sort of like to think about our behavioural work as being sort of in-home and out-of-home. And so with the work we do in-home, the model that we've had to date has been, you know, whether people like Pepsi or P&G have commissioned us to observe people in their home, and then we deliver data back into them. Now, so we're changing that to a model where essentially we're investing in collecting the data ourselves. So we're starting in January in the UK and the US to start collecting our own data, and then essentially packaging that up and reselling to multiple businesses, whether it's in snacking or cleaning or meal preparation or whatever it happens to be. And I think that's important for a few reasons. I think one is that it brings down the cost for doing this, because it's reasonably sort of pricey, intensive, pricey thing to do.
Yeah.
So I think when you can spread the cost of this thing across multiple clients, it makes the data cheaper and more accessible. Because the data collection is continuous, it makes it easier to train machines. So one of the problems is if we're on in people's homes for a couple of weeks and then stop, it's not long enough to actually train a machine to recognize behaviors.
Yeah.
But if we're continually collecting data on an ongoing basis, you know, it makes it easier to sort of train machines. And then the third reason is ultimately, you know, from an investor perspective, businesses that own their own data are more valuable as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big thing. And I think what we'd be looking to do is that's a service we want to grow. So we're probably going to start maybe in 100 homes in each country, but then, you know, the ambition is very much to try and grow that to, you know, hundreds, potentially thousands of homes. So it becomes, yeah, really significant industry data source. And then I think very much in the sort of out-of-home space, in places like convenience stores and quick service restaurants and petrol stations and sort of things like that, that is a relatively new area for us. And really, again, a big ambition is to sort of grow our business there. And again, you know, use the data we collect there to start training machines to recognize behavior in those spaces. So we've got quite good at teaching machines again to recognize how people move through a space and to sort of say, this is a person and this is how much time people are spending in different parts of the store. But, you know, if you could train a machine to recognize, when do they use a self-service kiosk? When do they speak to a member of staff?
Yeah.
When do they pick up and collect their order? Again, it starts to become more automated, more scalable, cheaper, and that again will sort of help the business grow. So those are sort of two big focus areas. And really, again, because we're not massively funded, then, you know, we're not necessarily, we are targeting quite significant growth, but not absolutely crazy. And ultimately the goal right now is that, you know, through revenue growth, through building our IP, through machine learning, through owning our own data, we'll grow the value of the company and attract more investment as a result. So that's really the sort of like midterm ambition, I guess.
Amazing. It's so, you know, insightful and eye-opening speaking to you about this. You know, I usually have people on the show, we talk about data occasionally, but never to this extent. And it's absolutely fascinating. So yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And, you know, thanks so much for your time. It's been excellent.
No problem. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Ben. It's a pleasure. So, yeah, thanks for your time as well.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.